And tonight on Coast to Coast, we'll be talking with Annie Jacobson about a couple of her amazing works, the latest Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. It's an amazing story. And also Area 51. And we're going to talk with her about both of these subjects when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Annie Jacobson back with us, investigative journalist, author. She writes about war, weapons, U.S. national security, government secrecy, graduated from St. Paul's School and Princeton University, a contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times Magazine from 2009 until its closing in 2013. She has several major books out there. One, of course, is Area 51, which we talked with her about several years ago. We're going to talk about that for a little bit tonight to set the stage for her latest work, which is Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. We've talked about that before, but she went way in depth on this. Annie, great work again. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is Area 51, is that being turned into a show or a movie or something?
Oh, I thought you meant maybe like a Broadway musical. Wouldn't that be funny?
That would...
Yes, the book that I wrote is being worked into a scripted television show. So that's an exciting thing when someone takes nonfiction and turns it into a great drama.
Well, that's going to be exciting. When might that hit the tube?
You never really know. We have a great writer in Chris Carter, who was the creator of The X-Files. So it's been a lot of fun working with him and seeing how like that kind of great creative mind really works at it.
Well, if you got somebody like Chris Carter behind this, you got a winner there, Annie, so good for you.
And our producer is Gail Ann Hurd, who has The Walking Dead on TV, so we have kind of the science fiction, it's really explosive.
There is a tie-in between your new work, Operation Paperclip, and your previous one, Area 51. There's a tie-in here. So let's talk a little bit about Area 51. And what did you do when you started investigating that? And of course, the CIA at the time, nobody admitted that it existed. What did you come across?
Well, writing that book was just an incredible experience, because it was like a bit by bit, I kept coming across more shocking information, and it was a real reporter's journey. It started for me just at a dinner party, sitting next to a physicist who I knew and had attended a sort of annual party for I think it was 8 years at the time, and he suddenly turns to me, and this is in 2009, and he says, "Boy, have I got a great story for you." He was late 80s at the time, and it turns out he was the physicist who invented stealth technology for the CIA back when Eisenhower was president. And the reason he could tell me this was because the agency had just declassified this program called Oxcart, which was a spy plane, a Mach 3 spy plane that was test flown out at Area 51. And so, learning that, and in this man's, sort of last years of life, where he was so excited to talk about this and tell this story that has been classified for, his whole adult life, was remarkable. And then when I really, got the sense of, my God, this was taking place at Area 51, this secret base, this, enigma in sort of American modern culture, he led me to, you need to talk to so-and-so and talk to so-and-so. And then you realize, wow, these are like a group of scientists and spy pilots and engineers and, all out there doing this thing in the desert in this incredible time. And they still kept in touch all these decades later.
My colleague, George Knapp, whom he lives out in that neck of the woods and, of course, has interviewed several people from Area 51, including Bob Lazar, who have, Annie, absolutely incredible stories about, craft and extraterrestrials and stuff. Did you take your investigation that far, or did you stay primarily on the military end of Area 51?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I approached it as a reporting about these incredible aircraft that were being built out there. And then, of course, the MiG was reverse engineered out there. But, you know, lo and behold, as it goes, being a reporter, and whenever I'm working with federal agents, FBI guys, or guys who work for the agency, it's like you see this spooky parallel between reporters and investigators because you're just following leads. And so, you know, to answer your question, did you mean to? Well, no, but you wind up there, and you wind up in places that are really kind of shocking and surprising. And as soon as the doors opened for me to the Atomic Energy Commission old-timers, these are the guys that wired the nuclear bombs out there in the desert, adjacent to Area 51. And, you know, for a long time, I think in American culture, we thought of those as two separate entities. It was just kind of reported as a coincidence that this secret base that supposedly didn't exist happened to be next door to the atomic testing range. And in fact, with my reporting in the book, I found that no, they were totally linked. I mean, one was keeping secrets for the other, and back and forth, and lots of underground, you know, the bunkers and the tunnels that were built underground, they had sort of a, you know, a link between them. And so all of this gets, of course, unfolded in the book I wrote about Area 51, but it was just endlessly fascinating. It was like door number one, door number two, oh, door number 13. And the mystery kept getting deeper and, unfortunately, more and more dark-hearted as I went along.
What do you think actually is going on at Area 51? It continues, and some of it is underground. What's happening there?
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, the weirdest thing of all is when I was writing the book, the name Area 51 was still classified. And so when I went to a couple large places in Washington, D.C., to, you know, to report and to do interviews, I was told, Annie, you may, you know, I always have a handler when you're with the press. I was told, you may not say the word Area 51 or we will ask you to leave.
Wow.
It was that, or no, they wouldn't say Area 51. They would say, you may not say a certain word or we will ask you to leave. And so there was kind of this odd game playing about referring to Area 51 as, you know, the test site, or, I mean, just, you know, the Groom Lake facility. And it seemed almost childish, but it was very serious, and not something I broke. I mean, I didn't want to be escorted out of the building, so to speak. But recently I was at the Pentagon, because I've written another book which is coming out this summer called The Pentagon's Brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought along my two colleagues from the Area 51 television show, Chris Carter and Gail Ann Hurd. They came with me because I was looking at and reporting on some of the science fiction writers that the Pentagon takes counsel from, believe it or not, or rather, you know, talks to about ideas. And,
yeah,
you know, Gail wrote The Terminator, Chris has The X-Files. So there we were at the Pentagon, and suddenly, because President Obama used the word Area 51 in public, it is no longer a state secret. And suddenly, we find ourselves, you know, having full-on conversations about Area 51 inside the Pentagon with, you know, high-ranking officers. And it was such an odd moment. It was kind of like being on the other side of the looking glass. Like, why does this all change with the twist of a president's word?
That's a good question. Why?
Right? I mean, nothing has really changed. And it says to me, and that's a long-winded answer, forgive me. You've got me on late at night, so...
That's all right. We've got a long show.
But, you know, I've always wondered whether or not activities are going on there to the same degree that they were back in the day during the Cold War. And it's always been suggested to me that the answer is no. And so I wondered if, you know, President Obama speaking of that kind of confirmed that. But then again, so much of this is about, you know, psychological warfare and disinformation. And countless times people, you know, point to me and say, well, she's disinformation, you know. And so certainly knowingly, that may not be the case, but one, as, you know, To quote Rumsfeld, you never know what you don't know until you don't know it, or you know it.
I get accused of that sometimes too. You know, I sit
yes.
back and go, what? I'm trying to expose some of the deepest secrets this planet's ever had. I'm not a disinformation, but people will take that and run with it.
Yes, and then, and also, you know, there is also the spooky idea. Maybe that's watching too much late night TV, George, but there is
maybe.
The idea that, wait a minute, maybe my source is giving me bad information. And I say that half in jest, because of course, as a, you know, as a reporter, I sit here with all of, you know, all of my notes and all re-listen to tapes and re-look at notes, and you're matching, you know, you're sourcing stuff against documents and secondary sources and, you know, archival things and journals and whatnot. But at the end of the day, boy, is the CIA crafty, and they're really good at information. And so you find yourself often in this kind of whirlpool of wonder, like what really is going on?
And they're very good. So how did this lead you into Operation Paperclip?
Well, when I was writing about the CIA's disinformation campaign with UFOs, which they did a lot of, particularly in the 50s, and looking at these Nazi aircraft that are shaped like UFOs, and these are old historical photographs from the National Archives that I found in files. Looking at these, I kept, you know, and the designers of those Nazi aircraft are two Nazi aircraft designers named the Horton brothers. And I kept coming across this name, Siegfried Knaemeyer. This is when I was writing the Area 51 book, because Knaemeyer was the boss of the Horton brothers. And not only that, he was the technical advisor to Hermann Göring, Reich's Marshal.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big title. I mean, when it, whatever was being built for the Luftwaffe during the war, it passed across Siegfried Knaemeyer's desk. Göring liked Knaemeyer so much that he referred to him as my boy. These are in German archival documents. And when I learned that just a few years after the war, Siegfried Knaemeyer was living and working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio with his seven children and his wife, I thought, how on earth does that happen? And then when I learned that Knaemeyer, when he retired in the 70s, after a long and prestigious career with the Defense Department, that Knaemeyer was given the Distinguished Civilian Service Award, which is the highest award that a scientist can get from the
yeah.
from the Defense Department, I thought, my God, this man went from being the most important guy to the Reich, as far as the Luftwaffe was concerned, to being one of the most important guys at the Defense Department as far as Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is concerned. And that really made me wonder, how does that happen? And that's why I decided to investigate Paperclip.
Did you know of the name Wouter von Braun prior to your research?
I did, because, of course, you know, he's such a big figure that, you know, how can you not know? And the amazing reporting that was done on this subject of Operation Paperclip by Linda Hunt and Tom Bauer, a British journalist, in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, is incredible in that way, that these were the first two people that exposed that, you know, folks like Wouter von Braun, and made it clear that these guys were by no means the good scientists that they had been, you know, pushed at the public as,
right.
but that they had Nazi paths. And so I knew, you know, from reading those books, I knew about quite a bit of it. And those are great books.
Annie, did we get the cream of the crop? Because the Soviet Union at the time grabbed its share of Nazi scientists as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, all said and done, on record now, we know of 1,200 Nazi scientists who came to the United States. And that's only on record. You know, that's after, like, lots of digging.
Yeah.
I write about 21 of them. I profile 21 in Operation Paperclip, who I thought were the most interesting. And boy, were these guys interesting, and that is in quotes. You say, did we get the best of the best? I mean, sure, if you think that getting Hitler's biological weapons maker is somehow the best of the best, then the answer is yes. If you think getting, you know, Otto Ambrose, who was tried and convicted at Nuremberg of, you know, mass murder and slavery, convicted, was in prison and then gets out, given clemency by us, and then works for us. If you think that's the best of the best, yes, we got the best of the best.
Maybe brains, but maybe not character.
These guys were, you know, writing the book was just it was sort of a shocking experience day to day, because I just really couldn't comprehend the degree of odiousness of some of these characters when I was researching their wartime activities, when I was in Germany, you know, at those archives looking at this stuff. It's head shaking. And I did spare readers of a lot of the gruesomeness of it, because, you know, people, I hope the book reads like a thriller. I've been told it does, but it can't read like a horror show, you know?
Right. Exactly.
And so I saw a lot of that stuff when I was in Germany, doing that due diligence as a reporter, you know, going to Dachau, looking at the archives, seeing the film, you know, seeing this evidence that is just stomach turning. But we, you know, these doctors, I'm speaking of the doctors here, these were Luftwaffe doctors, and they wanted to determine how fast humans could fly, how high the human body could go, things like this. And the way that they did it was testing it on concentration camp.
That's
prisoners.
Right. I'm not trying to put down Oppenheimer or Teller, but I am amazed that the Nazis didn't beat us with the atomic bomb. Just amazed.
I know. And you know what? This was like the one bright spot in a lot of dark spots writing this book. When I came across this quote, it's in one of Albert Speer's books, where he says the reason why Hitler did not pursue atomic weapons to the degree that he pursued other weapons was because, quote, it was Jewish science.
That was his biggest mistake.
Can you believe it? I mean, otherwise, that would have been an entirely different story,
yeah,
because in every other weapons field, the Nazis led, and they led by a lot.
Had he gotten that bomb, he would have won the war. We'd all be speaking German by now. And
absolutely.
God
and
knows,
I mean,
what would have happened.
Knehemeyer, who we spoke of earlier, who's that link between Area 51 and Operation Paperclip, at least for me as a reporter, Knehemeyer was in charge of the program at the very end of the war with the Horton brothers to try and create this long-range bomber that could get all the way to New York City and, you know, drop a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know whether it was an atomic bomb on New York City, but that was the plan.
Well, and they had those V-2 rockets, too. We're going to talk about that as well. So stay with us, Annie. Annie Jacobson, we're talking about her latest work, Operation Paperclip. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Last week, record viewership for our television show, Beyond Belief. Truly amazing. If you haven't seen it yet, or you're not watching it on a regular basis, go to this website, www.beyondbelief.com, and take a look. You will really enjoy it. Beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Back with Annie Jacobson as we talk about our latest work, Operation Paperclip, an amazing story. Let's go back to World War II, Annie, as Hitler was assembling these incredible scientists. I mean, they had incredible technology. They had the V-2 rocket. We didn't have that. How far advanced do you think they were outside of the atomic bomb were the Nazis?
Well, I think the spookiest programs were the chemical weapons and the biological weapons. And how far advanced they were, particularly in chemical weapons, was stunning. And I have I write about this at length in the book, because the documents tell this incredible story of how the Allies come across these weapons factories one after the next. Some are underground, some are above ground. This is as we're pushing, you know, into Germany and heading toward Munich. And one in particular that we came across at this facility called Rabkalmer. And, you know, you read the reports and it's like, you know, we roll up in the tanks and there's the big, you know, eagles with a swastika and, you know, everybody seems to be abandoned, and then they kind of are moving in cautiously, and they know there's, you know, the werewolf, um, the, you know, the paramilitary Nazis are hiding in the woods and getting off a few shots. And they're kind of moving through the facility. And then they start to realize that something's going on here when they come across a giant zoo with a lot of dead animals.
Oh, geez.
And then they come across photographs. And then, of course, this is a place where they've been testing chemical weapons. And not just testing them. So they're not at the point where it's like, oh, do they work? They're at the point where they're working, they're being manufactured by the tons, and they've actually been loaded into, you know, hardware, into ordnance, and they find these bunkers filled with bombs that are going to be literally tossed out the back of Luftwaffe planes, filled with a precursor to sarin gas that was called Taboon gas. And this stuff was so deadly that when the Allies brought a bunch of rabbits in to, because they didn't know what it was, they, you know, the yellow stripes around ordnance meant mustard gas, and some of these had like green stripes, and they're like, what is this? And they take a little syringe out and they test it on the rabbits, and the rabbits are dead, you know, in seconds.
Instantly, yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, what is this? And it's a great mystery why the Nazis never used these chemical weapons.
Because they were ready to be used, right?
They were ready to roll. They were in these bunkers. And, you know, there's lots of interesting documentation, and lots of great historians have written about, you know, different departments trying to convince Hitler to, you know, Robert Ley saying, you know, we've got to use these chemical weapons. We've got to give it to the Allies. And there's a lot of different arguments that he, Hitler may or may not have authorized it. But the most interesting one to me, and again, I don't know, but the most interesting supposition is that Hitler himself, this is a fact, Hitler himself was hit with mustard gas when he was a soldier in World War One, and he missed the end of the war. He sort of woke up in the hospital like, what happened? And the war was over, and he'd been gassed by mustard gas, and that he had this sort of weird, deep aversion to anything related to chemical weapons. Even though
it would have helped him win the war.
Yes! And again, it's like another one of these sort of odd things to really think about. Like, whoa, is that why, you know, this madman's personal fear or personal pathology?
It's not that he had scruples, that's for sure.
No.
But, you know, you look at what's going on, Annie, today with ISIS, and you sit back sometimes and you go, okay, how much do we as a nation take of this? So why don't you just bring out the big weapons? Why don't you bring out your chemicals? Why don't you bring out your nukes and say to them once and once only, this stops now. And if it doesn't, you do the horrendous things that you have to do. By the way, folks, I'm not advocating this. I get emails every time I bring this up. I'm simply throwing it out as a possibility. But you go to them one time and you say, we're eliminating every ounce of ground that you are on if we have one more episode. We don't get tough with them either. So for some reason, people tend, even as crazy and insane as Hitler was, he held back for a reason. And like you said, maybe it was because he experienced it so much and he realized how bad it was.
It's a great mystery, you know, but what I do know when you talk about the present war is that, you know, the phrase that keeps coming to mind is as old as the hill, or is at least as old as Sun Tzu, who said, you know, do not fight in the city. And there is the problem, that none of this apply. All these weapon systems and just having written a book about DARPA and the Pentagon, you know, having really, through interviews with top scientists, learned a lot of frightening things about different weapon systems that we have.
Oh my God.
They're all great in, you know, on a battlefield, but they're just not designed for urban warfare. And so the effectiveness that we have and the money spent and the power, literally, is very impotent in a city.
Well, they end up wiping out the population.
Yes, and also soldiers. I mean, so many soldiers are at risk by us putting our guys into those urban situations where there's, you know, you literally have no situational awareness whatsoever.
So these scientists are working on all kinds of projects then in Nazi Germany during the war. They're working on the chemical weapons. They've got the V-2 rockets going. They are working on the atomic bomb secretly. They're working on a special kind of flying machines. They're just going all out. They lose the war, and then we have all these incredible scientists. Whose idea? Who comes up with the Operation Paperclip idea?
It started out so simply, you know, as all great conspiracies do. I mean, again, you know, from the documents, reading these, you know, individual groups, whether it's Naval Intelligence or Army Ordnance or U.S. Army Air Corps, individual officers are tasked with locating the weapons in each division, okay? And as they, and the scientists, you know, imagine the nerdy guys, you know, accompanied by the beefy soldiers as they're moving toward Munich. And the scientists individually come across these weapons caches, and then they're like, you know, like, for example, the chemical weapons, the taboon bombs. Wow, we've got these incredible, you know, and they're writing reports, and we don't even know what it is, and they're interviewing all the scientists. And in that case, it was scientists with IG Farben that were leading the chemical weapons divisions. And if, and you know, you read the transcripts of how it goes, and it's, oh, I don't know anything. I'm just a scientist. And then, you know, as the interrogation becomes more intense and the threats get greater, more gets revealed, and then it becomes this subtle drama as you realize.
Then they cut their deals, right?
Yes, and the scientist is realizing, holy, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm either going to be hired or I'm going to be hanged. And there's, and then you see that motion toward, okay, well, here's what I know about it. And usually it's, let me introduce you to some of my friends. And then you see the American scientist then taking his memos, because these are all, I mean, it's amazing how many memos and documents there really are in the National Archives about this, if you look hard enough. And so then you see the American scientists writing to their bosses, be it in Paris, and then those memos get sent back to the Pentagon, and what they say is, listen, we've got this gas, we don't even know what it is, this chemical weapon, this nerve agent, but even better, we've got some scientists who we think were responsible for it. So can we just have a few of them? And that's always how it is in each of these divisions, Navy, Army, so forth. Can we do, we're just going to get a few of them. We just need a couple. And then a couple becomes a couple dozen. And then before you know it, you have General Eisenhower, who's in charge of everything in Europe as the war comes to a close and the surrender documents are signed. And then you have General Eisenhower writing to the Pentagon saying, what is the policy on these guys? And there begins Paperclip.
And when this was going on, how did the Soviets get their share? Who did that?
Absolutely at the same time. I mean, this, you know, the drama of the last month of World War II can never be understated, as you have the Allies coming from one direction, and then you have the Russians sweeping in from the east. And of course, you know, right around now, 70 years ago, is when Auschwitz was being liberated. And that's where, you know, we've been discussing the chemical weapons. That's where a lot of the documentation about those chemical weapons were. And there was another huge chemical weapons factory about 200 miles north of Auschwitz in Poland, because the Reich knew, we got to put these really important weapons this far east because the Allies don't come this far to bomb. And so the Soviets, as they're crushing toward Berlin, they're taking, you know, it's like a mirror. We're taking all these different facilities as we're marching in, and so are the Soviets from the other direction. And, you know, anyone who says the military-industrial complex began in the 50s, you read this book or you read these documents and you realize, oh no, 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 no. It began in the last month of World War II when the United States and the Soviets were fighting over who was going to get these weapons.
And back to again, did we get the cream of the crop to get this done? I think we probably did. Even though it was, I think, the German scientists that got Sputnik up and beat us in 1957.
Yes, the Russians. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so, but what's interesting, and I did not know this until I was really researching it. It didn't, you know, when the penny drops, when you kind of go, of course. And the of course moment for me was when I realized how much the Russians and the Germans hated one another. From, you know, Stalingrad on.
Oh, my God, they did.
They
and the German soldiers were petrified of the Soviets.
Yes, and so the part of the reason that we got the German scientists is because any German scientist that saw a Russian officer ran in the other direction as fast as they possibly could,
right,
into the arms of the Americans.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. So we get about 1,200 of these scientists that we know of, probably much more. Werner von Braun being them. Of the 21 you profiled, let's go through the ones specifically. I think eight of them worked at some point side by side with leadership. Who were the big ones? Who were the top ones? And was von Braun one of them?
Oh, my God. Von Braun was at the top of the list. He was number one on the blacklist, it was called. And, you know, it's in a really interesting kind of side story of betrayal. The British were so responsible for knowing about von Braun, for tracking the V2, for knowing where that underground factory was called Nordhausen, where the V2s were being built underground, assembled underground, because we had bombed, or rather the British had bombed Peenemünde, which was their original facility. So the British were like, I mean, just think about it. The V2s were coming down on them. And that was personal. And they wanted von Braun so badly. And we shared information with the British, and then once we had von Braun, guess what happened?
Of course, no more information.
No more sharing, you know. And it was actually interesting because we gave the British von Braun for about a week. And he went to, he and General Dornberger, who is this really odious fellow that I write about, and he became an American hero. And this, I just, you know, it's just stunning to me. General Dornberger was kind of worked, you know, von Braun was the chief scientist, and Dornberger was the top military person in this program. And the British gave us von Braun back, but they did not give us Dornberger back. They wanted to hang him, and they put him in prison. And then once they finally released him, we picked him up, and we brought him to America.
Did we pay them salaries initially?
Oh, my goodness. We paid them incredible salaries, and not only that, very shortly thereafter, we brought their wives and children over. But, you know, sometimes you come across these amazing details, and this was one of them, that not only did we pay them really well, but they weren't paying taxes.
Oh,
right?
And we housed them, I bet. We gave them...
Oh, my goodness. You know. And, you know, they started out, like, in these... they were supposed to be kind of semi-prisoners, in essence. And the guys that were at Wright-Patterson working on all the aircraft, they started out in kind of like a prison camp type scenario. And before you knew it, they had their own housekeepers. And they were having booze parties and, you know, playing poker.
Amazing.
And in a very interesting story. I mean, I really tried to make Operation Paperclip personal, you know, tell these personal stories of what these guys are doing, find the details, because that's always what I think is interesting. Otherwise, it's just like one odious Nazi after the next. I mean, how much can you take? You might
Jeez.
As well turn on and watch the ISIS beheadings, you know? I mean, it's that grim. And so when you can see the details of some of these guys, and they're just regular guys except for they're Nazis, I think it becomes more interesting, at least it was to Wright. And the guys at Wright-Patterson, one of the scientists, he was an engineer who actually, get this, what he bragged about in his, kind of on his resume, when he was getting hired as part of Paperclip, he bragged about the fact that he was in charge of building Hitler's bunker in Berlin. And he was like great with engineering projects. And so he was in charge of all the engineers who built the bunker. And this was a really big deal. I mean, we bombed the bejesus out of Berlin. Berlin was 85% nothing, okay? That's how many buildings were gone at the end of the war. And yet Hitler and his closest, inner circle were in that bunker and came out without a scratch, except for the bullet in the head. Self-inflicted. But in other words,
If
that
it
felt.
was self, if he didn't escape, there's talk that
Yes.
he, that's probably one of your next investigations. A lot of people think he went to South America.
One is never surprised. One can never rule anything out when you're in this dark territory. But
That's right.
the underground bunker, George Riquet came here because suddenly the Americans were like, wait a minute, we are now going to be in the business of underground bunkers now that the atomic bomb is a weapon of war. And so we brought Riquet to Wright-Patterson, and his undoing in this incredible personal detail that just sort of made me drop my jaw was he started Riquet, well, by day he was counseling Wright-Patterson, generals how to build underground bunkers, and that became the presidential bunker, by the way. But at night, Riquet and his friends would have booze parties, and they would play poker. And then they decided to branch out and buy booze on post. It's cheaper at a military
Sure,
facility.
right,
And
at
then
the
they would sell it.
commissary.
And they would sell it, like, sort of off campus. I mean, it's such a college kid thing to do, right?
Not
These
that
are
they
like
needed the money, right?
war criminals. And this is what led to his undoing. I mean, there was many other events involved, but I thought, wow, on some level, the foibles of being a human.
Selling booze did him in?
Selling booze did him in because there was a nerdy scientist who lived next door, who is the closest thing to not being a Nazi that there was, if you can give him a pass. This was
So
a fellow German.
he was an American or a German?
No, he was a German. All the Germans lived together only amongst
Okay.
themselves. And a fellow German, was angry that they kept having these booze parties. The guy's name was Nelson. They kept Nelson up too late, and Nelson reported him, and it caused a fight and tit for tat. And before you knew it, Nelson said, "I know," and pulled up Riquet's dirty laundry and told on him for being part of this hanging at this underground missile factory where von Braun was. And that
Amazing.
led to an investigation, and it ultimately led to Riquet's undoing, and he gets shipped back to Germany, and he gets put on a war crimes trial.
We're going to talk more about this Operation Paperclip next.